study this evening. We're going to begin what I've called lesson number 13, Social Gospel. And if you don't have a copy of the lesson, you may not get one. No, here's several. Most of you should have one by now. But the Social Gospel. When we talk about the Social Gospel, it becomes important, I think, for us to define what we are talking about and the attitude that so many have toward what the church is. The calls that I get here at the church building often reflect the attitudes that many have about what the church is supposed to be. And some believe that the church is nothing other than, as we've defined in the paper, just a pleasant community activity where one's children attend what we may call Sunday school, and where adults go to worship occasionally, and where one goes during the week to meet nice people. Now, there are some of you that have come from denominational backgrounds, and does that not just about summarize what some think that the church really is? That's what it does. That's what it is, and that's just a basic attitude that many have toward it. So, consequently, social activities have become such a part of many churches that it's common for people to think that these activities are identical with religion. And I think that's true. So many associate fun, food, and frolic. This is what the church does. And so if you want to have a good time, if you want to have some good people to associate with, and just simply have a good time with those people, then you become a member of a certain church, and you can enjoy those things. And we're going to demonstrate some of that, or illustrate it in just a little bit. So education, fun, food, they have their place in our lives, but that's not the work of the church. Now, we want to talk about that in some detail in this series of studies. In fact, I mentioned to Richard a few moments ago that in this series of charts, there are about 73 of them. So we're going to be on this lesson for just a little while because of its prominence. And I hope that's not disturbing or alarming to some of you, but some of the charts, I told Richard, we'll go through rather quickly and for obvious reasons. But all of these kind of things, education, recreational activities, social activities, all of those things, could they not have been accomplished without Jesus coming and without His shedding His blood? I want to suggest to you that in our study tonight and the next several Wednesday nights, if you'll just draw a big umbrella in your mind and think the blood of Christ, everything that comes under that umbrella should fit under the blood of Christ. Why He came. And if we come up with some notion or idea that won't fit under that umbrella, then it don't belong there. And it should not be a part of the work of the church. Now, in our study, we're going to talk about what the social gospel is, how it began to develop, and what effects that it has had upon the church, and what the mission of the church really is. And we're going to talk about what's wrong with it when we contrast it to the gospel of Christ. I'm persuaded that there are two attempts that we're talking about. One is the gospel of Christ. The other is the social gospel. Now, you know what Paul said about another gospel, which is not another. It's different. And I want to suggest to you that the social gospel is different from the gospel that you read about in your Bible. Now, what is the social gospel? First of all, the expression, ministering to the whole man. I don't know how many of you have read about various denominational churches or not, and read some of their advertisements and appeals to people to come and to be a part of them. But this expression, ministering to the whole man, is heard frequently in the denominational arena. Now again, some of you who have come from denominational backgrounds, would you confirm or deny that? Ministering to the whole man. That's a popular expression. But what that means is there are a lot of problems that plague the societies that we live in. There are such things as sickness, poverty, slums, drunkenness, and you can read a host of these on the board. And so if the church is to minister to the whole man, then we're going to have some kind of program to relieve some of these social ills. Now that's really what the social gospel is in a nutshell. So the contention then becomes that converting people to Christ, that is to make a Christian out of them, is somehow just not enough to deal with some of these social problems. Now I want to suggest to you that if you convert someone to Christ and that person is hung up on drugs or is a prostitute or a juvenile delinquent, as we see on the board, and a host of these other things, if you convert someone to Christ, will that not stop him from practicing these things? That's what repentance is all about. That's right. And if you convert that individual, and then you convert another individual, and perhaps they convert another individual, what are you doing to these kind of social ills that plague society? You're making some kind of inroads, aren't you? And the inroads that you make in converting someone to Christ is to save his soul. It's not just to relieve the symptoms of, let's say, he's an alcoholic, or he has some kind of connection to a gang, or perhaps he has entered into some kind of unlawful marriage relationship. You see, the point is not just to treat the symptoms, but get down to the bottom, the heart of the real problem, and that is to convert the individual to save their soul. Now, that's the thing that we're wanting to talk about in this study of the social gospel. Now, it's easy to see how, with a little distortion, a little spin, put on some of these things, you have turned the church into a social organization. And you've looked at what should have been byproducts of converting someone, and if you've looked at those things then as the primary objective. And somewhere in all of this, the truth has simply been lost. Okay? I want to look at another chart and series of charts. Now, these charts you've seen before, and I want to call your attention to the date that's on them. This date's probably before some of you were born, so you've grown up with this. And so, as far as the church is concerned, this is all you've ever seen. 1979, 1980. How many of you have been born since then? Bruce? Really? Well, how many of you have been born after 1980? After 1980. About half of the audience. So you've grown up with these kind of things. As far as your influence and the impact of religion, this is what you've seen. And I want to suggest to you that this is not the picture that's painted in the Bible. For example, if you'll look on the board, you'll notice that this is called the Family Flyer. And you'll notice that the very first advertisement is a schedule of fun for everyone. Now, it might interest you to know that this was published. In fact, this is a little tract that was picked up in the foyer of the Madison Avenue Church of Christ in Nashville, Tennessee. This was back now, 1979, 1980. I lived during that period, too. Some of you folks may not know that. But, just a little portion of my life. But anyhow, you'll notice who this is published by, a Church of Christ. And it's advertising a schedule for fun. Now, here's an appeal on the front page of it to try to create interest in all of the programs that they have. But I want you to look at some of the programs. Here's what's advertised on a Tuesday. Golden Agers. So if you're 55 or older, then you can get together with those folks and go to the state fair, and you'll meet at the women's building. You can also engage in the Belle Carroll River boat ride, or a Halloween party, or Christmas crafts, or a trip to the Hickory Hollow shopping mall. Now, a host of these kind of things are the very things that we're identifying as the social gospel. Now, how many of you in this audience, and I would like to see, just for illustration's sake and so that you can see others, how many of you have knowledge of so-called churches that do this kind of very thing? Every one of you. Every one of you. Now, does that give us some backdrop of the importance of this study? Look further what they were doing in 1979 and 80. Here is the Family Life Center operation hours. You'll notice at the top of it what time the track opens for jogging. And you'll notice also in some of these things, arts and crafts, another page. The instructor is named, the time when they meet is named. And you can engage in ceramics or macrame. Again, how many of you are familiar with churches that do this kind of thing? Well, again, almost half, if not better, of this class knows of churches that do this kind of thing. Now, how many of you know of Churches of Christ that do this kind of thing? Again, about half of the class. Now, that demonstrates the importance of this study, folks. And if you think the things that we're talking about are merely funny, or that they're merely things that just preachers talk about or Bible class teachers. You need to think again, because the Bible does not teach these things. Here's a copy of a leaf from the pamphlet, Physical Fitness, the Christian and His Health. And you'll notice down at the bottom of this, fall and winter upcoming sports events, jogging, walking, bowling league, volleyball, men and women, ladies gymnastics, basketball for men and women. And you'll like this one, first aid, CPR, classes on these kind of things. And you'll probably like this one too, volleyball and ladies gymnastics, and it tells who the instructors are. And babysitting, by the way, will be provided. 1979, 1980, this was happening. Here was a jogathon across the state of Tennessee. Bowling league. And let's just suppose you're worried about jogging all the way across the state. Here's the jogger's prayer right there in the pamphlet, so you know what to pray for. 1979, 1980. Now that wasn't new in those days, but this extent or extreme of it was on a smaller scale than it is today. Now you see how when something starts, it rarely ever stops right there. It begins to grow, and sometimes grow at great lengths. Here we see advertised basketball, intramural leagues, senior high boys, junior high, senior girls, and junior high girls, and officiating clinic. Now if you're going to go to a church that has a gymnasium and you can play basketball, don't you want to be sure that the officials call it correctly? So they have an officiating clinic. So if you want to, you can go there and learn how to call the basketball game. Now all of this is activity that is sponsored by the church. It's what the church is doing. And also upcoming events. Volleyball, softball, ping pong, fussball, fuseball, foosball. I called it fussball for a long time because it is something that you fuss about. It ought not be on a list of things that the church does. Now, here's the passage that we've been looking at from the beginning of this study. The passage says, "And when he was come into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came unto him as he was teaching and said, By what authority doest thou these things, and who gave thee this authority?" Now, that pamphlet that we just saw, I want to know, how in the name of heaven can these kind of things be practiced? Well, you answer that, say, well, it can't. Heaven didn't give the authority for these kind of things. We can't do these things in recognition of any authority from God because God hasn't given any authority for those things. Well, you ask the question then, how is it so many churches, even churches of Christ, engage in this kind of activity? Well, what's the answer to that? When Jesus answered the question, by what authority doest thou these things, and who gave thee this authority? How did he answer it, Katie? With a question. What was his question, Emily? All right, the baptism of John. What authority did John baptize? Well, the authority of heaven or the authority of men. Now, it's either one or the other. There's not any in between. Now, the things that we've looked at on the board that were advertised as activities, by the authority of heaven or by the authority of men, in the name of heaven or in the name of man. Now, there is no middle ground. Now, as we look at these kind of things, we have to ask that question, do we not? Now, what is the social gospel? We're going to see what it is, and we're going to see its history. We're going to see the adamant effect upon the church. But we're going to examine what the work of the church really is and what's wrong with the social gospel concept. Now these things are important elements that I want us to see. First of all, how did the social gospel concept get started? Now you can look in our notes and have a good bit of information, more than perhaps we'll have time to go into in our study tonight. But on page 2, we have some history. Brother Ed Harrell is a nationally known, and certainly was in times gone by, a national known historian. At one point, he gave a lecture, this was back in 1960, on the origin of the social gospel. Now, Ed Harrell and I don't agree on some things currently. But back in those days, he was doing a lot more history work, I suppose, than he was preaching. But the point was, in the history work that he did, he made several comments on the development of the social gospel. And he said, "The social gospel movement is a phrase used by 20th century American historians to describe a socio-religious movement which began in the years following the Civil War and reached a climax in the years immediately preceding the First World War. Brother Harrell went on to show that the movement grew out of the many social problems that developed as, quote, the United States was transformed from an agrarian rural society into an industrial urban one. Now that's interesting to me. Very simply, that's meaning folks moved off the farm and they moved into town. And when they moved into town, attitudes changed. They not only moved into town, but they became city folks with all of the implications involved in that. And that means you don't grow it for yourself, you don't obtain it for yourself, somebody else does and you buy it. Wouldn't that be a pretty loose description, David? And so that's what we are looking at when we turn from agriculture to an industrial urban society. But that also creates some problems, doesn't it? When you've got a lot of folks living in the city, now you've got a lot of city or social ills that plague that city. And the point he's making is that that grew very rapidly. Point number three, according to Brother Harrell, the problems of slum, drunkenness, prostitution, organized crime, juvenile delinquency, etc., etc., became the thing that most, and I'm not quoting right now, but became the thing that most so-called vocal professions began to address. And, of course, that included a lot of folks who were preachers. And they began to address these problems in the congregations where they were preaching. You say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, the social ills wasn't the problem. The problem was sin. And I think sometimes we get away from that and lose sight of what the problem really is. The problem is sin. And you address these things as sinful practices. You don't address them from the standpoint, well, let's create a program that will accommodate unwed mothers. Let's create a program whereby we can have some kind of addict prevention, or else take someone who is an addict and rehabilitate him. You see, these are social programs. When you deal with the subject of sin, you're pointing out that these things are sinful and try to get someone to change their heart toward these things. It's not just simply to change the practice of those things, but to change the way they think about those things, and not just in terms of whether they're socially acceptable, but in terms of whether or not they're right or wrong before God. Now that's where it has to start. And that's the church's responsibility. But it's not the church's responsibility to then begin to provide all kinds of accommodations for those who are involved in these sins. Do we see a distinction in those two positions? Anybody fail to see that? Well, as we read on, and point number five, these religious leaders, especially the more liberal ones, that is, toward the Scriptures, felt that the primary, and in many cases the primary message of the gospel was social justice. They felt that the church, as an institutional manifestation of Christianity, was obligated to do something about the contemporary social maladjustments. Now you see how that would begin as a result of war, civil war, and then begin to accumulate steam by the First World War. Wars often put people in decrepit positions. And then the church came to rescue the social ills of a society that resulted from those kind of things. And that's been ongoing ever since. The creation of more and more and more and more programs. And these saddled on the back of the church. Now, that's the background of the so-called social gospel, but we have to ask the question, what effect has that had upon the church? Well, during this particular time, if you'll note some of the history of the church, you'll notice that institutionalism did not begin just simply with the development of children's homes and benevolent societies. It began back in the 1800s, back about the time of the Civil War, just prior to the days of some of the events of the Civil War, with the beginning of the missionary society. And so what you've got is society upon society upon society, and by that I mean institutional programs that became attached to the church. In fact, in the directory of churches, now this is old dates, I understand that, but you'll see a contrast to modern dates. In the directory of churches in 1983, it lists 19 liberal arts colleges and universities. Now, I dare say today that number would exceed probably 25 or 30, if not more. And also 96 child care agencies and facilities. Well, you could find that many in one state today. And it says 37 senior citizen care facilities, most of which receive church support in one way or another. And that doesn't even take into consideration church daycare centers, kindergarten, elementary, and high schools operated and supported by churches. In fact, when I preached in Arkansas, there was a big disturbance in the more liberal church in town. And by that, I mean liberal in their attitudes toward the Scriptures. And the big blow-up had to do with whether or not that church should put in a preschool. Well, they did. They put in a preschool. But they had a great deal of controversy about whether they should have that there or not. So guess what the elders did for a solution? They bought a house that was on the side of the property where the church building was, and they moved the preschool from the church building into that house that was bought by the church. Now, that just made a lot of sense, didn't it? They just moved it from the place where they assembled for worship into another building. But it was still the church engaged in that same work. Rearranged the furniture. Exactly right. Still doing the same thing. Now that salves the conscience of a lot of people, but that don't, as we say, cut the mustard. Now the staff of many churches of Christ have every kind of minister that you can imagine. Youth ministers, ministers of fellowship, ministers of music, ministers of this and that and so forth and so on. But you don't read in the Bible of all those different kinds of ministers, do you? But you can find many churches of Christ today that have them.
I'm on the website for that same Madison
Church. Oh, mercy. How far have they gone now?
It's about the same, but I mean, as I just looked down their index, they have a Christian Care Center, they have a Get Connected Life Groups, the Madison Student Ministry, Scouting, the Valley View Camp, the Benevolence Center, the Christian Counseling Center, the Christian Women's Job Corps, something called the Comfort Zone, the Media Center, and a prison ministry.
Mm-hmm.
In their benevolence area, they have a food pantry, clothing room, Meals on Wheels, room at the inn, where apparently they are taking care of homeless people or something like that, a furniture center, and they do sewing.
They do sewing too, huh? Place to take your socks. Well, you see what we're talking about. Young people, do you see what we're talking about? I think it was Al one time. I'm going to talk about you, Al. Don't do that. Al was talking to me about some places that he had worshipped in the past, and correctly he made the observation that some of the places that he had worshipped in the past, he didn't see a whole lot of difference between them and denominational churches. You remember that conversation? But you do now, don't you? Yeah. Well, you see, and his point is right, and it's well taken. Between a lot of churches of Christ and denominationalism, there's very little difference. The practices are nearly the same based upon what you just read there and what we saw up here. Their practices really haven't changed much from today till back in 79 and 80, but the theme of them is still the same. That's right.
Maybe after service you could explain to me a little better. These are all honorable and good things.
They're honorable and good things, just like mowing your yard. But it's not the... That's right. It's not the work of the church.
Well, but it's the work of the Christian.
Yeah. Well, let's hold on. What we have is individual responsibility versus the responsibility of the church, you see. The church has some very defined responsibilities. Now, though we might look upon these things and say, well, this is, seems like it would be good, remember the text that says there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. And just because it looks like a good work to me doesn't make it a good work. And it might very well be a good work for me individually to do, but when I incorporate the church into it, now it's not a good work for the church to do. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Life, but I
It's okay.
I want to talk to you afterwards.
Okay.
What would be an example of how a good group of people could go ahead and collaborate?
Okay. Okay, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. Richard?
And I think that's one of the things that started things off badly in the 1840s for the Lord's Church when things went off to the Christian Missionary Society, is that people, even who were supposedly as upstanding as Alexander Campbell and people mm-hmm. like that, who had left denominationalism to attempt to find the truth, finally said, these people aren't doing what the gospel says that they ought to be doing. Therefore, since they as individuals are not doing it, we'll make up for it by making a society and making the church do it.
That's typically the plea.
And that didn't make it right.
Didn't make it right. And we're not questioning the integrity of the people either, Roy. We've got some honorable people. Okay. Okay. But your question is good. Well taken. Bruce? Goes on and on, yeah. Goes on and on. But as we talk about the social gospel, let's keep our minds focused upon some of these social ills and the effect that it's had upon the church to try to step to the front and supply what appears to be accommodations for these kind of social ills. Now, the kind of things that we have described, if you rolled the clock back past Civil War days, and especially if you roll it back to 2nd, 3rd century days, you don't find these kind of things. You certainly don't find them in first century times. These things are relatively, and by that I mean within the last 100 or so forth years, 150 years, they're relatively new. You don't find them back much beyond that. Now, what has this done? I want to talk with you about two or three passages to get this thing kicked off. What has this done? It's turned our minds, it's turned our thinking from things spiritual to things material. Now, I want to look at three passages relative to that. Yes?
Real quick, what you were saying earlier, the Catholics do like soup kitchens and stuff like that.
I didn't hear you. Soup kitchen?
Catholics.
Okay. Well, yeah, you're right. From about the 3rd century, yeah. Yeah, but within the Lord's Church, you haven't had these kind of problems until relatively recent. I recognize denominationalism, especially the Catholic Church, probably introduced a lot of these things, but be that as it may. But our thinking has been turned. It's been turned from spiritual things to material or secular things. Let's open our Bibles, if you will, first of all, to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Now keep in mind, we're just kind of kicking this off this evening and getting started in our study. We're going to plow a little deeper as time goes on. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning at verse 18, it says, "For the word of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us who are saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning will I bring to naught. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For seeing that in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom knew not God. It was God's good pleasure, therefore, or good pleasure through the foolishness of the preaching, to save them that believe. Seeing that Jews ask for signs, and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto Jews a stumbling block, and unto Gentiles foolishness. But unto them that are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God, and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For behold your calling, brethren, that not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God chose the foolish things of the world, that he might put to shame them that are wise. And God chose the weak things of the world, that he might put to shame the things that are strong, and the base things of the world, and the things that are despised, did God choose. Yea, and the things that are not, that he might bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory before God. Now, let's talk about that. Here's the wisdom of man versus the wisdom of God. The wisdom of man, could it ever know the wisdom of God? No. What did it take in order for man to know God's wisdom? God had to reveal it. He had to reveal it. Now, if I want to do something with God's approval, the only way I can know that that's right is to read it in what He has revealed. Now, that's been the whole series of studies from day one on the subject of divine authority. The only way I can know that something pleases God is to find it revealed here in this book. Now, the wisdom of man did not know God. God chose the foolishness of the preaching, the foolishness of the message preached, to make known His mind. Now, when He did that, man thought that it was foolish. Hold on, David, I'll get right with you. Man thought that it was foolish, didn't consider it wise at all. But when God continued to reveal things, man continued to measure what God revealed by his own human wisdom standard. And you know what? Every time he came up thinking that God was foolish. Now these Corinthians, just because someone has become a member of the Lord's church, doesn't make you immune from that. These in Corinth, these who were Christians, they were a part of the church of God which is at Corinth, 1 Corinthians 1 verse 2. Paul refers to them in chapter 2 verse 1, or chapter 3 verses 1 and 2, as carnal. They were carnal. Now here were folks who were members of the church that still think like the world thinks. Now do we have folks today who are members of the church that think like the world thinks? And I'm not talking about immorality or things of that nature, but I'm talking about things where we run ahead of God and we think this will help God out if I do this. And if we assign this on the back of the church, it'll help the church to be more effective in this area or that. And we're running ahead of God, trying to solve all of these social ills by social programs, rather than to solve the social ills by teaching somebody the gospel of Christ and converting their heart. David and then Joey. Several places. In fact, three prominent places. Yes, and there's one in Proverbs.
And then the very things that we've been talking about, like direct commands, necessary inference, or apostolic consent, we have none of that concerning baseball or football
no.
or any kind of sport.
No, we begin to think carnal-minded when we think that's what the church is. That's right. Joey, David, and then Peggy. Yeah.
He's really elevating his own opinions equal or greater than that of God's. And this whole idea that you just elaborated on is depicted with the story of Naaman.
Sure it is.
Because God said, this is what you need to do to be healed. It's like, well, I don't really like that. I'd rather do this or I'd rather do something different. And that's like a very representative of the kind of attitude you're talking about that the Bible condemns.
Sure it is. Man begins to think ahead of God. That no flesh should glory before God. David, Peggy, and John.
A lot of times justified with the secular definition of Bible words, fellowship.
We're going to get to that.
It gets really misused. It has
yes, it does.
And stuff, and so we justify by using the secular meaning of fellowship instead of the Bible meaning.
True. That's right.
It's different. So people justify their acts by
Yeah. I want to do this, so I'm going to.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. A lot of times they have a preconceived idea of what they want to do,
mm-hmm.
so they look for the ways to do it.
Well, that's right. And we want to see a change in thinking that takes place, a change in the way we think. Well, yeah, well, that's true. Well, that's all it was advertising, his activities. It wasn't teaching anything. That's true. John?
It all comes back to what you know. I mean, it's like you say, it's, no one's going to come out and say, I'm a false teacher. I'm going to teach you error. So it's all about what you know. These people, they don't set out and they say, well, this is God's idea, but I have a better idea, so I'm going to go do that. It's, the teaching usually is watered down, so they don't know what God's idea is, and based on what they know from the world, hey, this is a good idea. So a lot of times they're wrong people. They just don't know.
Well, that's true. What I want this class to do is, rather than necessarily talk about us and them, let's talk about us. We'll illustrate with them, but let's talk about us. I don't want any of you young people to allow your thinking to drift because you see this in other churches of Christ, you see this in denominationalism, and so you begin to think that this is okay, because your mind is drifting when that happens. In the Colossian letter in the 3rd chapter, you'll read in verse 1, Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. He says, if then you were raised together with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated on the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are upon the earth. Think about that expression. Set your mind on the things that are above, not upon the things that are upon the earth. Here's a fellow over here that's a drug addict. Here's another one and another one and another one. And so what I'm going to do is create a program so he won't be a drug addict. Have I set my mind on heaven, or have I set my mind on the things of the earth? Well, now, there might be some confusion in our mind. Well, which one is it? Do we need to make some kind of clear distinction as to where that falls? If I create program after program after program to solve social ills, where is my mind set? Now, don't answer that the way you think I want it answered. Answer correctly.
If you're doing all these programs,
that's right. I'm not teaching someone the gospel so he can go to heaven. I want to teach him how not to be an alcoholic. Well, I'm sure he has a whole lot more problems other than just alcohol, you see. So if I teach him the gospel of Christ, I can change his heart. Now, that's our goal. Now, when I said I don't want you to answer the question like I just might want you to, answer it correctly. Well, I want you to answer it correctly, but I don't want you to answer just to please me. I want you to know what the book says. Joey, and then Bruce, that's you.
In my observation, my experience, that if somebody studies the Word, I mean really studies it, not casually reads it, really studies it, and conforms their life to the gospel, all these other problems take care of themselves and go away.
That's the point, Joey. That's exactly the point. You convert his heart, you'll take care of his alcoholism. Okay? Bruce and Joe, did you have your hand?
In that case, you're addressing the root cause of the problem.
It's sin. That's the problem.
I just had two things. If you didn't be risen with Christ, seek the things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God, the King James says, set your affections on things.
That's right.
And not on things upon the earth.
These are the things where my affections need to be,
right.
Not on solving social ills.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's a denominational practice often in and of itself. But we need to define what the church is and keep in the forefront of our minds that the church is not intended to be some kind of a organization to solve all the social ills that society has. The church is a spiritual house. In 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 5, 1 Peter 2, verse 5, your Bible says, "But ye also as living stones are built up a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." The church is a spiritual house. It's described as a family of God, built by Christ. Upon this rock, He said, "I will build my church." He gave His blood to purchase it. Acts chapter 20, verse 28, and we're going to reflect upon that one many times. The price of the church was the blood of Christ. He didn't die so we can play basketball. He didn't die so we can create a program to take care of people that have social problems. He died to save our souls. He died to purchase the church. And so the church is a spiritual body. It's a spiritual body of saved people. The Lord added to the church those that were saved. He is the Savior of the body, Ephesians chapter 5, which is the church, beginning at verse 23 and in particular verse 25. Now if we can define what the church is, and understand that it is a spiritual house, wouldn't that go a long way in helping us to determine that the work and mission of the church also is spiritual? Now the reason I'm persuaded that so many think that the church is to be involved in social programs is we've missed the point of what the church is. I get phone calls, I mentioned at the building, folks wanting to know what kind of program you have for young people. You and I both know what they're asking. What kind of ball games do you have? What kind of activity? Where do you take the young people? What kind of things do you do? Well, I say we have Bible classes. We teach them the gospel. Click. Not interested in that, of course. We don't want to do any of that. David. Roy, do you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Okay, David. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true.
So I think sometimes we need a definition
of the church.
Yeah, of spiritual.
Yeah.
So we can really know, you know, any of that stuff that we've heard, we can get it out of our mind and concentrate on that which really is spiritual.
Well, that's right. That's true. We need to know what the church is and what spiritual function that it really has. Now we've talked about some of these things, and this is going to amount, you're not going to do that now, are you?
Yeah, yeah.
This is going to amount to a review of some of the things we've talked about. But if the church has a spiritual mission, then let's define what it is. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15, this is in your assignment for passages to remember. What does this passage teach us? Now, it's easy for me to say what's in the verse and ask you to identify the verse, especially when it's on the board, but to show you the verse and ask you to tell me what's in it. Tell me, what's in 1 Timothy 3, verse 15? What's there, Joe? The church is defined. What is it? Joey? David?
The pillar and the ground of the truth.
That's what the church by definition is. Let us understand that the church is not defined as an organization or an institution that provides a solution to social ills. The church is described as the pillar and ground of the truth, 1 Timothy 3, verse 15. That means it has the responsibility of upholding and supporting the truth. Now that's different from becoming a social organization. The church has the responsibility of upholding and supporting the truth. Now you'll notice on the board a number of passages. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 8, we see by example, here's what the church in Thessalonica did. They had sounded forth the word. They had sounded it forth. Now, as they did that,
They were fulfilling their duty and their responsibility as a spiritual organization. They were teaching what God wanted them to teach. Verse 8, "For from you has sounded forth the word of the Lord, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but in every place your faith to Godward has gone forth, so that we need not to speak anything." The church in Thessalonica was busying themselves with a spiritual work. Can you see them building a home for unwed mothers? No, they were too busy sounding forth the word of God. They were teaching what it says about fornication and such things. Now, in 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, Paul affirmed that the church in Corinth had the authority to support a preacher among them. God had ordained that. That those who preach the gospel are worthy to be supported of the gospel. We see in Acts the 11th chapter in verse 22, the church at Jerusalem sending forth Barnabas as far as Antioch. In Acts the 13th chapter, we see the church at Antioch sending forth Paul and Barnabas. In Philippians chapter 1, verses 3 through 5, the church at Philippi having fellowship with Paul in the preaching of the gospel. Philippians chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, they sent once and again, he said, unto my need. 2 Corinthians 11, verses 8 and 9, Paul robbed other churches, taking wages of them, that he might not be burdensome unto those in Corinth. Now when you look at all of these passages that deal with the early church engaged in the work of evangelism, you see the church doing its work as a spiritual institution. You don't see it becoming some kind of a secular organization that then gathers funds and sends them on so that they can relieve social ills. That's not the function of the church. Does anybody see that? That's good. And of course, we've looked at this side of the chart to see the absence of this in the Scriptures, but this is the one I want to focus on from these passages. Here's the church doing its work as a spiritual organization in the work of edification. We haven't been very long past till we've talked about that. Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 16. We've noted the organization, the church, and through it, it can build up itself in love. In chapter 4, verse 14, God does not want us to be tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine. He wants us to be established in the things that are right. The church can do that. It is so equipped. Let all things be done unto edifying, Paul said to those in Corinth. The work of the church can be done by the church. It can build up. It can teach. It can even provide for the indigent among its own members. Now, does that mean the church has become a reliever of social ills? No. The church has the responsibility to relieve the destitute among them. What about society? Society's not in that picture. The church has a responsibility to relieve those who are destitute among them. We see that in Acts 2, Acts 4, and Acts 6. And in Acts the 11th chapter, what do we read about? John? Acts 11. Great. You did good. I saw that anxiety. But that's exactly right. Exactly right. They sent relief. And we'll talk about these other passages in a little bit, okay, next Wednesday evening. Be sure, if you don't have one of these lessons, it's going to be easy for us to venture off into other areas. And I want to stay focused on this particular lesson. If you don't have one, they're right up here in this black box. Be sure you get one and be sure you study it so we can stay focused on track of what we want to talk about. What do you think of that?